It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. Our guest will tell us why soup is good food, not just for eating, but for bringing people together.
But first, there's been a lot of conflict and a lot of partisanship in Congress over the last year. Our next guest says the budget deal reached by Congressman Paul Ryan and Senator Patty Murray could provide a model for getting things done in 2014.
G. William Hoagland joins us now. He's Senior Vice President at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a longtime congressional staffer. Bill, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you, Rob.
In a piece you co-wrote this week in the Christian Science Monitor, you say the key to that Ryan-Murray budget deal was that both sides were willing to hold their noses and pass this thing. Why is that the key?
Right. Well, I think the bottom line is that we haven't been able to accomplish a great deal in terms of congressional action over the last many years. In fact, quite frankly, we haven't been able to do a budget resolution for the last 4 years. And I think that the point has come to where when you have a divided Congress, a Senate under one party control and a House under another, and it's the only way you can get anything done is to compromise. And while neither side got what they wanted totally, at least they were able to find some way of splitting the issues and getting to a point where they could actually do something and move forward with a budget. Nobody likes the compromise, I guess, when you're a partisan. But in this particular case, a lot of credit goes to Chairman Murray and Chairman Ryan for at least finding something that was good to middle ground to move Congress forward on putting together a budget that hopefully will avoid a government shutdown here in January and move us forward to maybe doing some other things on a bipartisan basis in 2014.
Well, speaking of the shutdown, this deal came just a couple of months after the fall shutdown. Did that jolt people on both sides into saying, hey, maybe we don't need to hold quite so firm on principle and be more willing to compromise?
Oh, I think it had a big effect, particularly on the Republican Party in the House and in the Senate. I think the bottom line there was that people held Congress and particularly held Republicans accountable for the shutdown and basically blamed everybody, including the president and the Democratic-controlled Senate. And so this was a move. The shutdown probably provided some incentive for let's do something. Let's show the American public that even in a divided Congress, we can still do something. And again, I would want to emphasize this is not this is not something that's a great deal in terms of a deficit reduction. In fact, in the near term, quite frankly, it adds slightly to the deficit. But it did show that Republicans and Democrats could come together on something to keep government open, hopefully here in January, and move forward and fight on the issues later on. But at the same time, that there is a way to find middle ground on very difficult issues.
You worked on Capitol Hill for a long time. Were things different, and if so, why? Why was compromise more possible back then and not now?
Oh, that's, of course, one likes to think that things were always better in the past. and maybe that's true. I think there was we didn't have quite the degree of partisanship. There was fights. We had difficult fights. I worked for Republicans that fought with Democrats. But at the same time, there was a willingness to come and recognize that at the end of the day, you had to set aside your very partisan positions for the good of the country. And if that meant compromise was not a four-letter word. It was a good outcome, and so long as it kept things, people without having to overly compromise their positions, we were willing to work together. Was it different in the past? I will only point out that we've had real divisions in this country. Let's just not forget about 150 years ago when the country was very divided. So it's not like we haven't had difficulties with finding a middle ground. But I think it's been very difficult over the last 5-10 years. It's been extremely difficult to find a middle ground when you have a divided Congress. I don't want to say that things are necessarily any better or worse. I do think that there was a willingness amongst the leadership in the past to sit down, work with the president, and find middle ground that hasn't been there, quite frankly. And I think it's a pox on both houses, both Democrats and Republicans, for their some partisanships that have been existed over the last few years.
It seems like there's a basic conflict when you get elected. On one hand, people want you to stand your ground, hold firm to principles, fight for what you believe in and what the people who agree with you believe in. But there's also an ideal of somebody who's willing to cooperate and compromise and make things work. You worked in Congress a lot. How do elected officials strike that balance?
It's very difficult. You're absolutely correct. You fight, you hold your position as long as you can, but you do not take yourself over the cliff. At the point where you recognize that you are an elected official for the United States and the United States totally, not just for your district, not just for your individual state, but you're working, you are a United States representative, you're a United States senator. When you recognize that what you're there for is to find that middle ground, that common ground for the good of the nation, I think you recognize you have to find compromise, you have to find a way to reach across the aisle. You've taken as far as you can, you've argued your position as long as you can, but at some point you have to come to grips with the fact that the other person may have a point of view also, that you have to find some way of working together to move forward for the betterment of the country in total. And that, it's hard. I'm not going to suggest in any way, shape, or form that it's not difficult on these members, and particularly on their parties and their constituents back home, and they are held accountable. But at the end of the day, statesmanship comes forward, and they do what is right for the country.
Looking ahead to 2014, what kind of deals do you think there could be that maybe modeled on the Ryan Murray budget deal that passed this month?
Well, again, each individual issue that comes up will be fought hard on both sides. First of all, I would expect that when the Congress returns in January, that the first issue will be that they'll have to deal with what we call the appropriation bill that will keep government funded. There'll be resistance to this, and this will be the first implementation of the agreement that Ryan and Murray reached. That will be difficult, but I think that will show that at the end of the day they can move forward. More importantly, the next step will be the Farm Bill, and I think the Farm Bill is on its way to becoming a law of the land, and it again will show that people have had to move off of their maybe hard-pressed positions to find the middle ground. Finally, I think it's still possible, though this will be a heavier lift, on immigration reform. I think there is a good indication that Speaker Boehner wants to find some approach to immigration issues, and I think that also is possible in 2014. Accomplishing all of that and then doing what we call getting ready for the fiscal year 2015 appropriation bills is another major effort which will take place, but it will be focused primarily on the agreement that was just reached because it sets the levels of funding for 2015. If we accomplish all that in a midterm election year, I think that will be considered somewhat of a success for the 212th Congress.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Bill Hoagland. He's Senior Vice President at the Bipartisan Policy Center. We've got a link to his Christian Science Monitor piece on the Central Time Facebook page.
And coming up, it's Food Friday, and we're going to be learning about the social benefits of soup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's winter in Wisconsin, the time of year where a lot of us are ready to, well, just hibernate in our homes and just stir for a warm, hearty meal every now and again.
And a lot of us turn to soup for those meals, but our next guest says it's a meal that's best enjoyed with other people. And she says hosting soup nights can be an incredible way to bring people together and create a sense of community.
Maggie Stuckey is a writer and author. Her new book is Soup Night, Recipes for Creating Community Around a Pot of Soup. Maggie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, tell us about this idea of soup nights and how you got into them.
Well, I was invited to attend one at my hometown of Portland, Oregon. This is a soup night that's been going on. By the time I first met them, they'd been going on for about 5 years. It is all the families on one block, corner to corner on both sides of the street. They get together once a month. One person, one family volunteers to be the host for that month, and they make two big pots of soup, one of which is vegetarian, and they serve soup and bread. And people sometimes bring other things, but that's not part of the deal. Their whole focus is, this is a very urban neighborhood with all the demographic variables that you would kind of expect in a big city. And the there was a feeling by a couple of the families when their kids were really young that they wanted the children to be able to go outside in the front yard and play and be kids and not be afraid. Not if there was somebody coming down the sidewalk, they wouldn't have to have that moment of panic of, you know, whether that person's going to represent some kind of threat. They would know that it's a friend because they'd seen them around the neighborhood and they knew them on a real basis. And this one mom was, she was trying to imagine how they could create that kind of environment. And the idea that she came up with is, let's just make a giant pot of soup and invite everybody and see what happens. And what's happened is that they have created an unbelievable real community on this one block. It's like a little small town smack in the middle of a big city. They're all very different from each other. They wouldn't naturally form any kind of connection or bonds of friendship because they have so many different interests and different ways of living their life. And yet, because they get together once a month and they have this meal together, they all kind of know each other in a really special small town kind of way. It's absolutely amazing and wonderful to watch.
So this was actually formed with the intent of trying to bring the neighborhood together.
Yeah.
Did it work?
Very, very, very deliberate intent. And the reason that it works is they all made a commitment to be inclusive. They invite everybody. I mean, it's real easy to have a party when you invite people you already know. And that's fun. And, you know, nobody's saying don't do that. But if your goal is to get people to know each other, then you have to include everybody.
And did it work from the get-go? I mean, did it just take off and keep going?
It did. It absolutely was so important that they, this neighborhood also has a block party in the late summertime. And it's so easy, it's so popular that all they do is somebody puts out a sign-up sheet at the block party and people get into arguments because they enjoy it so much. They want to make sure that they get to do it. So the sign-up sheets fills up in about 10 minutes, and that's all there is. It's so easy. Part of the reason it works is it's easy. All you do is you make the soup, and you probably send out a kind of an information sheet, either by email. Sometimes people do a small flyer, and the kids, you know, go up and down the street and hand it out. One of the things about this particular soup night, and I actually found this in several other places, is one of their goals is that whoever is the host that night shouldn't be burdened with any extra work, including dishwashing afterwards.
Nice.
So part of the deal is you bring your own soup bowl and spoon and then take it back home with you. And so the first night I was ever there on this block, I stood on my brother's front porch and I watched this lovely parade of people going down the sidewalk and everybody's carrying an empty soup bowl. It's absolutely charming.
That's great. Now, you mentioned elsewhere. Is this an idea that's picking up outside of Portland where it sounds like it started?
It very much is. With when I started to really explore this and to look into it somewhat, I very easily found almost 50 different neighborhood groups around the country. I should say different groups. Most of them are neighborhoods, but sometimes they are organizations that aren't a geographic neighborhood, who host some kind of regular event, all with the same goal and all with the same mechanism. They did somehow it's a soup. It's a meal about soup, and every one of these groups has the same purpose, which is using it as a way to get people to know each other better. 30 of those groups are profiled in the book, and they are all over the country, literally coast to coast. And the really cool thing about this is every soup group I found is in a big city. I didn't find any in the suburbs. I mean, maybe people in the suburbs already know each other, but I would think, just if I hadn't had this opportunity to speak to all these people, that people in big cities have a tendency to kind of want to stay inside and just be kind of socially closed in and keep to themselves and just a few close friends. But in fact, these people all have exactly the opposite. They wanted to know their neighbors. They wanted to reach outward and build a community. And it is so wonderful to talk to them. They are so proud of what they've accomplished. They love to talk about it. They love to show it off. They're so excited when somebody comes to visit from out of state and it happens to be on a soup night. You know, they always go, they tell their, you know, mom and dad visiting from back home, you got to come and see this. You're just going to love it.
And we want to get into some of the recipes in a second or two, but I want to talk about the whole soup premise first of all. Would this have worked as well, do you think, if it were, you know, pizza night or cheeseburger night or something like that?
I think it would have worked almost as well, because the whole thing is, you know, to get people mm-hmm. together. First of all, when you get people sitting around a table and sharing a meal together, something good is going to happen. But I have concluded, having watched this over a couple of years now, that the soup itself adds an almost magical quality, because there's something about the soup as a dish. It's warm, it's comforting, it's nourishing. I mean, when we all remember when we were kids and we were sick, Mom brought up a bowl of chicken noodle soup and we instantly felt better. Soup just makes you feel better on so many levels, and it's. I was at a soup night once when I was watching a couple of people who don't know each other, but they were sitting opposite each other on the table, and they both had their hands around the bowl, kind of warming their hands, and they would lean in and they smell how wonderful the soup smells, and then they made eye contact and they realized they were both kind of doing the same thing, and they smiled at each other, and that's the beginning of a relationship.
I want to spend our last couple minutes talking about the soup itself now. Can you give us a couple of your favorite? You divide it up by season. Can you hit us with a couple great winter soup ideas that we can use here in a cold month in Wisconsin?
Isn't it great soup weather, boy?
It is. It is.
One of my favorites, and it's my favorite for several reasons. One, it's very inexpensive, and you almost always have the ingredients on hand. Is African peanut soup, which is basically a rice, tomato, chicken stock, or vegetable stock, but it has a good big spoonful of peanut butter in it, mm-hmm. which adds protein if you choose to make it a vegetarian version, and adds this kind of mysterious flavor that nobody can really identify, and they end up saying, what is it that I'm tasting? And when I say peanut butter, they don't believe it, but it's really, really wonderful. There's a number of soups that use kind of good leftovers, like some people still have their leftover turkey stock from Thanksgiving, maybe. Turkey and bean, and turkey and kale and bean. It's almost like asking a parent which is your favorite child. There's 99 soup recipes in the book, and I have to say I enjoy them all.
So let's say that somebody wanted to start their own soup night in whatever town or city that they live in. How do you get started doing that?
Well, if you're in a neighborhood, that's kind of the easiest way to think about it. You maybe you're going to go your whole block or your cul-de-sac if your neighborhood is organized that way. The very best thing to do, pick a night. Early Sunday evening seems to work well for people, and a good time frame so that people know there's a definite thing they can think about in terms of time. I'm going to say, let's say 6 to 8 or 5 to 7. So it's going to be a school night, so there's still time for kids to get organized for school tomorrow. For the first time, the person who's doing it should be the host, and because then they can explain what the idea is. And go to every house, have a small handout ready to leave if people are not home, kind of explaining the idea. I found it works really well if two people go together, so that you choose as your partner somebody who knows the folks that you do not know. So between the two of you, you will know almost everybody. And then you just sort of introduce yourself. Hi, we're having soup at my house this coming Sunday. Hope you can come. Here's some information about it. I talked to a woman a while ago who told me about her experiences starting up, and she said, I never had anybody say to me, go away.
That's great. Maggie, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That's Maggie Stuckey. She's the author of Soup Nights, Recipes for Creating Community Around a Pot of Soup.
Coming up Monday in Central Time, we'll find out why trolls are a part of one Wisconsin town and the history behind them.
And we'll hear about Wisconsin's wolf hunt. It just finished up. We'll hear what it means for the future of our wolf population. That's coming up Monday on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll be talking with a journalist who went undercover to an elite butler school in the United States. He'll talk about what it's like mastering the art of serving the wealthy. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. La Crosse was rated as the second most exciting small city in America. We'll find out why, and we'll hear your thoughts in the next hour.
First, we're going to go behind the scenes of a booming profession.
From the years 2000 to 2012, in spite of a global recession, the number of billionaires in the United States doubled, and the number of people with at least $50 million in wealth has grown to almost 50,000.
The economic prosperity of the super rich has spawned growth in numerous service jobs, including what's called private service. That refers to butlers, housekeepers, estate managers, chefs. While servants like those in Downton Abbey may seem to be a thing of the past, turns out they're not.
And in order to get a better sense of what these jobs and what the training for these jobs are actually like, one journalist went undercover and enrolled in America's most prestigious butler school. John Davidson is here with us to share the inner workings of this growing profession. He is the author of The Long Road North, and his latest book is The Obedient Assassin. His article in the January issue of Harper's is You Rang? Mastering the Art of Serving the Rich. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Gene, how are you?
I am great. I want to start out, in the introduction, we said that you went undercover, but, you know, when I read the article, I couldn't tell whether you actually went undercover or whether you actually enrolled in this with the idea that you might wind up working in the profession someday.
It was sort of a matter of both. I did go undercover. And I did think that I might end up doing going into service. I had spent about 10 years writing a novel and had gone through a lot of money and sold a house, and my agent hadn't been able to sell it. So I'd always been interested as a journalist in the relationship between servants and masters and how it worked. But by the time I started this, I realized that if I was offered one of these jobs, one of these six-figure jobs, that I might need to take it, or that I would take it. And as it turned out, that did not happen.
Yeah, and we will follow the arc of your story as the half hour progresses here. But I got to say, before I read your article, this is one of those things that I'd never given a second thought to. It had never occurred to me. I guess, you know, somewhere intellectually, I knew that the super rich had to have some help of some kind. But it never occurred to me that there is so much of it out there, so much so that you need training for it. And that, tell us a little bit about what the market looks like right now and what that industry, if you can call it that, looks like.
Well, it's most of the industry is somewhat under the radar. And the Department of Labor does not track butlers or chefs or house managers, but everyone who's in the industry says it's a growing industry, it's booming. On both in California and in New York, there are many placement agencies, and all they do is place servants or, you know, private service people. And but it's hard to say exactly how big it is. There's now an organization called the Domestic Estate Managers Association, and they have about 2,000 members, and but nobody knows exactly how big it is. So, but it's growing apparently.
So let's start back with your story, and let's start where you started at the Starkey International Institute, which sounds pretty impressive. But what's it like, really?
Well, it's an old mansion. It's a Edwardian mansion in downtown Denver. It's close to the state capitol. It's about two blocks off of Colfax, which is sort of Skid Row in Denver, and it's very, it's a step back in time. And I was surprised that the program is as, that it seemed as Victorian as it did. The students live in the mansion, and there were 12 of us to begin with. There was a one-week course, and then there's an eight-week course. I was there for 8 weeks. And we act as the servants, and we run the house, and we do rotations, so that over the course of 8 weeks, we're trained in these different jobs, how to run the kitchen or how to be the house manager, that sort of thing. The woman, Mrs. Starkey, who started the school, she acts as a principal. And
what's the principal?
And the principal is the missus or the madam or the employer.
There you go.
And so she is the lady of the house. And as the students, we had to use the back stairs. We had to dress in uniform the entire time we were there. We couldn't use the front door. We couldn't come or go by the front door. We called everybody Mr. and Mrs. We were all called Mr. And so it was very much like it was very much the way I would imagine a Victorian household would have been. And so it seemed pretty authentic to me.
And what were the other students like? Because it seems to me it takes a particular kind of personality to sort of work in these types of jobs, to work for very wealthy people and sort of always be on call and always be on, perfect.
You're absolutely right. One of the things we did in the school, one of the exercises we did was to try and identify the source. We talked a lot about what they referred to as the service heart, and this is the desire or willingness to serve, or the eagerness to serve. And you have to be ready to get on somebody else's agenda and sort of submerge yourself in somebody else's life. The students were, for the most part, they had some university education. They were a more impressive group than I expected. A lot of them had very good experience. One had been an assistant estate manager. A couple had cooking backgrounds, but they were just they were pretty regular people, and they were sort of who you might meet at a dinner party.
But even though you talk about the service heart, there was the promise of a pretty good job after the school, and you guys had to pay for the privilege, and pretty handsomely, I might say, to attend this institute. But then at the end of it, there was a pretty good, maybe even a six-figure salary waiting on the other end.
Well, that's what...
That's the theory anyway.
That was the theory. That's what we went in thinking. Yes, the tuition was, if you lived in the mansion, it was you paid for room and board, and that came to almost $17,000. And so yes, that's a lot of money. And the Starkey advertises a placement rate of 95%, but after we got there, then what we started hearing from the staff was, well, a third of the students get placed from the program, on finishing the program. Third get placed by the end of the first year, and a third decide that they aren't really suited for private service. And I think three people out of my group, out of the 10, had jobs at the end of the program, and which would be what they, you know, what they predicted. And and I'm not sure. I think perhaps seven or eight have ended up in private service. But sometimes, since writing the story, I heard from a woman who was in another class, and there were only four students, and no one in that in that class got jobs. What I discovered, and what this other woman said she discovered, was that what people really want, what the super wealthy really want, is someone who has experience. And one of the key questions is, have you worked in the home? And if you haven't, then it's having a certification doesn't necessarily get you a job.
We're talking with John Davidson about his article, You Rang, Mastering the Art of Serving the Rich. And we're going to be continuing that discussion in just a moment.
And you can join if you have questions or if you have done this work, if you've been a butler or other private service profession that we've been talking about or gone through one of these training programs. Love to hear from you. We're at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're back with John Davidson. He is a journalist and author of a number of books, including The Long Road North. But we are talking with him this half hour about his article just published in the newest edition of Harper's, You Rang, Mastering the Art of Serving the Rich, about his time learning to be a butler, I guess you would call it. And John Davidson, I want to talk about that training a little bit. You know, when I was reading the article, I just had this vision of, I think it was Anthony Hopkins in Remains of the Day, if you remember that movie. And he was always so formal, and he was just always on, and the house was just so much of him. And I'm wondering, how do you train for something like that? And when you wound up at the Starkey Institute, where do they start with you, and where did you wind up? Because you had, I guess I would call it a series of ups and downs.
that's true. The focus at the school has shifted somewhat from training butlers. There were a couple of people there who, on the staff, there was a man there who had worked as a butler. There was another man who came through and was working as a butler. Butlers are pretty much for show. And if you have a butler, that means occasionally they're referred to as eye servants. It's
like eye butlers. Candy.
Yeah, exactly. Butlers open doors. Butlers are there for to be seen. And so a lot of it is appearance, and then there is part of it. I mean, at one point we were trained in how to, as a butler, how do you help somebody in and out of a car? How do you hold a door properly? And what is tricky about being a butler and service in general is to be able to serve and to be there, but to be unobtrusive and if possible, almost invisible, which is contradicts what I just said about being an eye servant. But you don't want to be noticed too much. You want to be, and a lot of it is demeanor. A lot of it is, as I understand, playing a role. And if you've seen butlers, if you've seen Anthony Hopkins, then you might model yourself after Anthony Hopkins. And you know, part of it is dress too, how one dresses.
But a lot of it is also sort of manners, how you present yourself, how you speak to the principals, how you interact with them. I mean, there is an awfully lot to learn, but a lot of it really does come back to making the help sort of be invisible and making the house sort of run itself.
Mm, or make it appear to run itself.
Yeah.
And yes, traditionally in England, there were always servants who were considered back of the house, and then there were the servants who, the butler, the footmen, who are there for show. But we did things like we had exercises in how to make introductions. We were trained in table setting. We had to set tables, and then in service, we put on these two formal dinner parties that were very complicated, and they were 9-course dinner parties. There were 12 people at the table, and we were trained in something that is known as mirrored service, which means that all of it's choreographed. All of the servers move at the same time and do the same things at the same time, and it's like doing a little dance over the course of a 3-hour dinner party. And so that's, I would say, that may have been the most intensive training in service. And then part of it was practical. We did all of these jobs, and we served each other, and we also, at these parties, we poured coffee and passed desserts around and opened the door and met people's cars and that sort of thing. So a lot of practical experience.
But then a lot of other mental experience, too. I mean, you had to write a family tree. You had to write out service visions and all sorts of other activities like that. And at one point, Mrs. Starkey, I think, said that 60% of the training that you were going to receiving was psychological. So what was she talking about there?
I think that idea is, I think it's might come from the Marines, perhaps.
Mrs. Starkey and the Marines, or?
Well, you know, a lot of people in the military go through this program and have gone through it and do very well at it because they are accustomed to taking orders. But I think the theory was you're broken down and then you're recreated in as a private service professional. And yes, but in the beginning, it's called Starkey Household Management Software, and it's this very complicated program, and which we learned how to use, and then we wrote what were our books, which were our service. It was our either imaginary or real house where we wanted to work. And so one of the things you do is, if you're in service, you need to know everything about the people you work for. And eventually you do, but down to, we talked about flavor profiles and does the Mr. like chocolate? Does the Mrs. like red wine? What are their allergies? What are their food allergies? And then we would do family trees for the family, where they came from, what cultural, what civic organizations they belong to, what their education was, that sort of thing. And if you run a house like this, eventually, you do end up creating a very large document, and a lot of it is, you know, when Uncle Joe comes, does he drink scotch or does he drink bourbon? And then a lot of it is has to do with the warranties and the service manuals for all of the appliances and all of the in the house. So yeah, it's quite complicated.
And as you got into it, you talked about, you know, the idea of being broken down. You had some pretty rough moments where you didn't think you could do anything right. It was kind of a success at the end. But tell us about some of those dark days there, because there are people listening here who are thinking, well, how hard can it be? You know, you're dusting, you're chopping onions in the kitchen, you're cleaning the bathroom. You know, we've all done that.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the work, and I have done all of that and pretty well at it, at doing it. But a lot of it was being willing to be, to subordinate oneself to this system. And when I got there, I didn't realize that we were going to actually act as servants all of the way through, and I didn't realize that it was going to be that that one would need to be that submissive, and I think I clearly was not suited to it in terms of taking orders. And so I bridled, and I was surprised at the other students that everyone would knuckle under as much as they did. And we were told that we were being trained to be professionals, but we were being treated as servants.
We've got a caller who would like to join the discussion. Let's go to Milwaukee now, and Deborah is with us. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, my father was a butler. He's died in 97, but he worked for a family in Dallas, and then I ended up meeting the family he worked for when I was a little girl, because they had a home on Lake Superior in the Upper Peninsula at Huron Mountain Club, which was Henry Ford's old cabin, and it was huge. It was not like your little cabin, but so
right.
I remember that, and then that's how my dad met my mom, because she worked at Huron Mountain Club in the kitchen. And then I ended up being a nanny after I graduated from high school in 1975. I worked for many wealthy families for 15 years in Westchester County, New York. I worked for the president of Ragu in Connecticut and in Dallas. And I highly recommend the nanny profession for young girls out of high school who aren't sure what they want to do, because it was just delightful. It was just a wonderful experience. I can't tell you how impressionable the whole experience was for me. It's like a bag full of memories.
Deborah, thanks so much for the call. And John Davidson, in listening to that family connection there, that's kind of what I think of when I think of the service industry like this. You know, that you sort of have to have an in, and you alluded to that earlier in the discussion when you said they're looking for people who've worked in a house like this.
That's right. And I think being a nanny, starting as a nanny, is a very good way to get started in private service. And a lot of people who become house managers or estate managers start as a nanny, and they're part of the family. The family trusts them. They know about the family. So it's sort of an organic evolution. And I think as a rule, that's how people get started with a family. It's not necessarily as a nanny, but they might be somebody who works in the family office, or they might be somebody, a waiter at the country club that they're fond of, that they've gotten to know. And they're looking for somebody who's familiar.
Well, John Davidson, we are out of time, but thanks so much for joining us this half hour.
My pleasure, Gene.
John Davidson has been with us. He is author of The Long Road North and The Obedient Assassin. We've been talking with him about his article in Harper's this month, You Rang, Mastering the Art of Serving the Rich. And you can find out what happens to him if you read it.
Coming up, it's day two of Kwanzaa. We're going to take a look at the Kwanzaa tradition, what it is, and where it came from. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. News is coming up next on Central Time, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.